Jason News Talk. Justice Andrew, along with Sam, 651-989-5855. David Gartensteiner-Oss, counterterrorism expert, going to be joining us just after 7:30. Going to get into a lengthy discussion about social media. One of the topics about that is, in his view, tend to agree, social media provides the wrong incentives. He took a sabbatical from social media for a while, but is re-engaging after spending a couple of years largely disengaged. So we're going to dive into that with him. Did you hear, by the way, that the new head of the we'll talk about this at the end of our conversation with David, because I want to get his thoughts on whether or not he thinks this means anything. The new head of the FBI here locally is an expert in counterterrorism. I thought that was rather interesting. I don't know if we should be putting, you know, if we should be reading into that, or if we should just say that sometimes, you know, the best FBI guys or ladies in this case happen to be also experts in counterterrorism. Real quick though, we're going to get to the drapes and U.S. Bank Stadium and then Trump's meeting on guns, but a couple of holdovers from last hour, Drew. Out of Bloomberg, YouTube's new moderators brought in to spot fake, misleading, and extreme videos, stumbled in one of their first major tests, mistakenly removing some clips and channels in the midst of the nationwide debate on gun control.
Yep. This is, look, you know, you're seeing this happen with not just YouTube, but you're seeing it happen on Twitter. You're seeing it happen on Facebook. You know, you're getting people in there that are, you know, if I'm going to give, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt for the sake of argument, right? And let's say, you know, they want to clean up misleading, clearly fake, you know, clearly designed, you know, information stories, videos, memes, whatever, that are clearly designed to, in their opinion, misinform people, but their inherent biases are sort of taking over. Because, you know, they're probably, you know, people are inclined to associate themselves with like-minded people. So if you got people of a certain worldview and a certain mindset that are running these companies, they're more likely to hire people that are of a similar mindset that they're more comfortable with. So I think those inherent implicit biases against, you know, conservative leaning content is taking foot here and is causing them to look at something that they just disagree with. And then thinking that it's, oh, well, this is clearly misleading. This is clearly false. They're trying to misinform people. So we're gonna put this in that fake news box.
I have a huge issue with this. The Google division said in December that it would assign more than 10,000 people to moderate content after a year of scandals over fake and inappropriate content on the world's largest video site. I got a huge, huge problem with this on a couple of different fronts. But one, we have an update later on in the show about the Supreme Court testimony going on about whether or not you can wear political attire when you go to the polling booth. And we had Kim Crockett on from the Center of the American Experiment talking about this very issue. But it falls along the same lines. What criteria are you using? Are you just talking about things that are political in nature? Are you going to go down this road on everything? And here's a really good but very sort of John example for you, okay? There are plenty of videos that get produced out there that present, say, misleading thoughts and theories about movies and things like this. Okay, so what is your standard and what are you trying to curtail? Are you trying to curtail harm against individuals? I was just reading a thread from a Lucasfilm employee who was attacked in a vicious by Twitter standards way because somebody decided to post a video where it showed her at Lucasfilm and on the desk somebody had a photo taken from Return of the Jedi and Luke Skywalker was X'd out. And this person went on this rant about how this shows how much Lucasfilm and Disney disrespects the fans hates what Lucas has done. My point being is that
ridiculous.
It pushed this Lucasfilm employee to basically say, I'm done. I'm gonna get off Twitter for right now because people were attacking her over it. So my point being, if they're going to go down this road, are they going down every single avenue? And who's going to be the ones to ultimately decide what is real content, what is fake content, what is influencing? Because I'll argue that any video that you put out there of a movie reaction or somebody commenting on a political story, that's all influencing. All of it's influencing. This is they can do whatever they want to do, but man, This is a real, real dangerous. I don't want to say censorship because these outlets are their own, but
yeah, I don't consider it censorship because it's not the government that's doing it. But you're right. I mean, these Google, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, they're so big that when they decide to go this route, it essentially amounts to censorship. I mean, it really does. It makes it very, very difficult for people of a certain mindset, for conservative, leaning content to find that audience because that's where the audience is. And it is unfair. I would really prefer it if you're going to be just a content platform. You know, if your business like YouTube or Facebook is just an avenue for people to post content, then get out of the way.
Right.
You know, let it be.
Have your decency standards, which kind of already exist on YouTube.
You can have some obscenity standards pornography standards or things along those lines. Sure, you can have some standards. But otherwise, when it comes to just political content or opinion-based content and things like that, just get out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah, because you're going down a path that I don't think you want to follow, because you're going to end up, if you want to take that route, you're going to end up with just this homogenized, stripped-down version of just the most benign, stuff.
It's going to end up being where only content of a certain political mindset is tolerated and accepted.
Right. We already do a pretty decent job as a society, and this... For some reason, the bathroom, the transgender bathroom debate popped into my head, because I'm of the opinion that as a society, we already did a pretty good job of dealing with all of that. But be that as it may, we already do a pretty good job of sort of socially policing this stuff. Like that kid, there was that YouTube star that posted the video of somebody that committed suicide and then made some comments about it.
He stumbled across
a body or something to this effect. Well, yeah, you know what? People kind of spoke up.
Right.
And, YouTube didn't need to handle that. They kind of took care, society kind of took care of it on its own.
The quote-unquote marketplace.
Yeah.
In this instance, it's not really like a marketplace in the economic sense, but the marketplace of ideas and what's acceptable content and what isn't, kind of took care of that situation all on its own.
Yeah, the shutting entire channels would have marked a sweeping policy change for YouTube, and that's what happened. Some YouTube channels recently complained about their entire accounts being pulled. Which typically only removes channels in extreme circumstances and focuses on disciplinary action of specific videos. But YouTube said some content was taken down by mistake. The site didn't address specific cases, and it's unclear if it meant to take action on the accounts of the individuals that were mentioned in this particular story. The YouTube official policy is that harmful or dangerous and hateful content can violate its guidelines if video creators break the rules 3 times in 3 months. But they already have a... YouTube's already got a pretty good way of going and complaining, and they go and investigate and they take stuff down. And I know they still have to determine that, but if they're kind of getting out ahead of it.
Right. Well, but the problem is they're not consistent
in
that. You know, if they're like bullying, for example, if they're going to say that, some YouTube channel is harassing you and bullying you, and, that's grounds for it being taken down, then they need to be consistent with that, but they're not.
Another quick hit, then we'll get to Drapes out of Fox News. So Kevin Smith, suffered a heart attack. Thank goodness he went in and had a doctor check it out. The Widowmaker, as the most cardiologists call it, was clogged. Usually that just, it kills people. So taking to Twitter, Clerks and Jay and Silent Bob film director revealed that he suffered the massive heart attack, went into detail his symptoms, share his appreciation of all the staff and doctors who saved his life. Okay. That was all fine and dandy until Chris Pratt, the actor. It's so funny in the story.
I believe he goes by Star-Lord.
It's funny in the story. I know I'm not going to take issue with it, but you two guys will. They said the Passengers actor.
That's the film that they kind of settled on.
Of all the films?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
They could have done Parks and Rec.
Yes, no.
They could have done Jurassic World.
No, literally anything.
They could have done
else.
Guardians of the Galaxy.
But he is the Passengers actor. He is a Passengers actor.
I had to pick that crappy.
Yeah, it was really good. You haven't seen it. You don't know.
Yes, I have.
Did you watch it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I gave up on it.
Oh, okay. Well, see, then you...
I didn't finish it.
You should have finished it.
No, because it was terrible.
I tried to watch it with you that one time on the plane. John.
I know it broke.
But
it broke.
The Lord decided it was not to be.
The Lord. Well, that makes sense. We were flying at the time. We were closer to God.
Yes,
You know, that makes sense. That would make sense. Yeah.
The mountains.
That was a very positive intervention on your behalf, Sam.
I was very frustrated. So, Chris Pratt, this is get back to the core of the story here before I made a stupid observation, sent well wishes and told him how he was inspired by Clerks while he was a senior in high school. The actor then tweeted he was praying for him and that he will continue to do so. When I saw it, I was like, hey, man, cool. I pray myself. I believe in the power of prayer. I was like, that's cool. I'm proud. I already like him as an actor. I like him as a dude. And then I was like, and you're going to take a whole bunch of heat for saying that.
I know. I can't believe that the word praying has become such a trigger word
so
for people.
Stupid.
You know, what does it mean at its core? Whether or not you believe.
It's just well wishes.
Whether or not you believe. Even the power of prayer, whether or not you are a religious person or an atheist or whatever, praying simply means I'm sending you well wishes. I'm hoping for the best.
Yeah.
You know, I'm giving you well. Why can't you just take it at that? Why can't you just take it at that face value? But no, you got a bunch of jerks out there that got to push back anytime somebody uses the word praying.
One user tweeted, is it part of your alleged deity's master plan that Kevin had a heart attack?
Well, I bet he felt really good after he sent that tweet, huh?
Yeah.
So I wish,
if I were Pratt, I would have responded. It could have been. I don't know. Yeah. The Lord works in mysterious ways.
Maybe.
Sometimes through a passenger's actor.
Perhaps Kevin's going to learn something from this.
In another tweet, Pratt asked others to pray with him, and that triggered even more backlash. Some users said it was inappropriate for the actor to solicit additional prayers online. Oh, now we've got people that believe in prayer going, solicit for more. That's not how this works. There's more important things God has to deal with.
Oh, my goodness.
The director, Kevin Smith, did take to Facebook Live to update his fans on his condition. He's now a vegetarian, he said. He's had to cancel his second of two shows. But he did go on to defend the actor, according to Variety. Poor Chris Pratt, one of my favorite actors on the blanking, on the planet. Blanking put up a nice tweet. But he just loves the profanity. Where he's just like, hey, man, I don't know you that much, but I love Clerks and I'm praying for you. And apparently people were like, blank your prayers, and attacked him in blank. He continued and said, and number one, thanks to Chris Pratt. How sweet is that? Number two, please don't fight over stuff like that. It's a waste of time, whether you're religious or not. Someone saying, I'll pray for you. It's good intentions.
That's all. You know, and it piggybacks on with this, you know, this ridiculous Joy Behar controversy where, you know, she mocked Mike Pence for being a man of prayer, you know, and seeking God's counsel on decisions and called him mentally unstable because of it. You know, Oprah comes out a couple days later and is like, the only person that could get me to run for president would be God.
Right.
You know, okay, Joy, any comment on that?
Yeah, thanks for stirring that pot, Oprah.
Thanks, Oprah.
Well, we already know it's a very benevolent God because it kept you from having to watch Passengers. So I'm sure Oprah will make the right decision.
And I've watched it several times since then just to make up for it. So,
but why?
Out of the, because have you seen it yet?
I don't want to.
Okay, well, say, you know, you need to watch it then.
No, she doesn't.
Yes, she does. I watched it with my, I did watch Passengers, and then we'll get, after coming up, we'll get into the drapes. I did watch Passengers with my dad and stepmom when they came to visit a couple weekends ago. It was really, really funny, though, because you want to talk about the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. The next time we got in the car together to go for a drive, my dad got into this big philosophical discussion over the decisions that were made in the movie. And it's like, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's where I came from. I'm just as God and my dad made me. You can blame him. 651-989-5855. Looking forward to talking with David coming up. We'll talk talk drapes on the way and Trump and
really,
guns.
Really expensive drapes.
Yep.
Justice and Truth.
Welcome back to Twin Cities News Talk, Justice and Drew. David Gardenstein-Ross is going to be joining us just after 7:30. Sitting down last night, minding my own business, working on prep.
We're going to talk about this?
Yeah, we are. I just made a command decision. sitting down, working, just minding my own business, and I don't know how we started. We did, the three of us started texting each other, and then Drew mentions, hey, you need to watch this Netflix reality show, The Push. And what really got me to that was Drew basically said, hey, I don't want to say anything about it. I just think it's something that you really need to see, and it's something that you're going to want to talk about afterwards. I'm like, oh, that's cool.
Right.
Yeah, my buddy's thinking about me.
It's very much a
conversation-provoking
documentary.
So I did. And I kind of wish I hadn't.
It's disturbing, isn't it?
Yeah, not disturbing in a disgusting way. It's
No.
It's a reality show where they kind of...
Documentary.
A documentary, right, where they show how people can be influenced by society and people around them.
Right.
And if
social conformity or social compliance is sort of the theme of it, where, you know, you find yourself in a situation where everybody is sort of doing one thing, and you may not agree with that thing, or
right,
you may not understand that thing, but because you don't want to be the sore thumb that sticks out in a room, you kind of just go along. And it starts rather benign by putting a bunch of people in a room, and three of those people are told, they're actors, they're told every time they hear a bell, ding, every time they hear a bell, they stand up or sit down.
Right.
Dings, they all stand up. Dings again, they all sit down. Other people start coming into the room, not given any instruction whatsoever, and they all start doing the same thing. Like, after a couple times, when the bell dings, they all stand up, and it dings again, they all sit down. They have no idea why they're doing it, but they're doing it because everybody else in the room is. Then the three actors leave, and it's just the people that have been given no instruction, and sure enough, every single one of them stands up, sits down every time the bell rings.
Right, but before that, there's one person, and we're not giving anything away because this is like the most benign part of the experiment of the show.
I don't want to give anything
away. No, we won't give anything else away from the show because this is just sort of the setup on this. But with that scenario, there's one person that decides they're not going to go along with it, and subsequently somebody comes out of nowhere and removes that person from the room.
Right, very creepy.
And it just kind of it cements like everybody else's mentality. But I started watching it last night before I went to bed, and because I keep a real strict bedtime, I tend to turn it off. So this morning when I got up and I was doing prep, I finished it. We've been talking about it since we walked in the door this morning because it's just... The show really opens up not just what, in my opinion, what they were trying to do, but a whole myriad of other questions. And it relates a bit to this conversation that we're going to get into with David Gartenstein-Ross and social networking and why he left social networking and kind of the influence and the negativities that goes along with that, because there's a lot of parallels within this particular show of social situations about how people tend to go and follow along with like minds, even if it's things that they don't necessarily agree with, just because of the fact that other people are and they want to be a part of something. And this goes back to when you talk about news outlets that are in their own bubble, people with like-minded individuals around them making decisions, how you have an individual who runs for office and is one party but then ends up being elected, where he's surrounded by people from a completely different party, and suddenly that person ends up buying into all the things the other party goes along with. I mean, it really, really, it happens. And it happens, I think, a lot more than people know.
It's not something I've given a lot of thought to, but watching that documentary, it's called The Push. It's on Netflix. I highly recommend
it. You gotta watch it, Sam.
Go watch it.
We can all talk about it together.
Watching it, you know,
it right now.
Really made me think about that sort of social compliance. And it's the type of thing that you watch and you can't help but have the conversation afterwards of how would you react in that situation? What would you do in that situation?
Nobody call. Sam, go watch it while you can still push the buttons and stuff like that, but nobody call because Sam's gotta watch The Push right now so we can talk about it together before the end of the show.
It's only an hour long.
Yeah.
You can get right through it.
I can do it.
All right. U.S. Bank Stadium needs massive curtains to block the sunlight during the 2019 NCAA Final Four. They won't be cheap. Do we need to say anything else? How stupid is that?
Yeah.
What were you thinking? It's in a request sent.
How was this? How are we just finding out about this?
Well, let's jump to...
After the 2019 Final Four was agreed upon,
they
agreed to come here, all the deals were done, and now they come up and they're like, oh, by the way.
Well,
you need $2 million worth of drapes.
The MSFA received the rights to host the Final Four in 2019. So in 2014,
does it have to be at US Bank Stadium?
2 years before the building opened in August of 2016, Okay, the Vikings. This was 2014. Vikings and local organizers won the rights to the Super Bowl. In a separate proposal at that time, this is back in 2016, the MSFA received the rights to host the Final Four in 2019. The effort is being overseen by the Minnesota Corporation, led by Kate Mortensen. She wouldn't comment on any aspect of the drapery, including whether her organization would help cover the cost. My assumption here, because they don't say this in the story, my assumption is that this was agreed upon back in 2016, and that when they said that all the games need to be uniform, because that's the reason why this is, is that they require that every single event looks the same when they're covering it. I think what happened was they approved it back in 2016, says, hey, we're going to make sure that we block out the light, and they just went, oh, okay. And didn't give any other further thought to it other than that back then. That's my assumption.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll take care of it. Yeah, we'll hire some dudes.
Sure, whatever. We got unlimited pools of money to pool from, so what's the big deal?
The MSFA chairman, Mike Vekic, sought proposals for the design, manufacture, installment, and testing of a blackout curtain drapery for the stadium. The MSFA wants the curtains to be reusable for other events, including concerts. The primary use will be for the 2019 NCAA Men's Basketball Final Four, the request said. Permanently installed hardware would facilitate repeated use of the system where it is possible. In an interview, Vekic declined to provide the price range for the project, although he said it would be expensive, obviously. You get further in the story. It says at the 2017 meeting, the board received a memo about the anticipated capital expense of $2 million for window washing equipment, as well as a blackout curtain and other expenses. They said the window washing equipment wasn't purchased because it wasn't deemed to be immediately necessary. I just didn't. They're windows, right? They're eventually going to have to be cleaned. right? The 19-month-old building has 200,000 square feet of glass, according to the MSFA website. Then there's the roof, half of which is translucent plastic polymer. And the light sources must be draped to meet the NCAA specifications. The NCAA requires lighting to be consistent for the shoot-arounds and the games of all four teams, regardless of the time of day. Just expense upon expense upon expense.
It's crazy.
You spent how much money did we spend to begin with? You didn't have this in the budget.
Maybe we should just
foremost.
Look, the MSFA has the rights to host the Final Four.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't necessarily mean it has to be at US Bank Stadium.
That's true.
You know,
right?
We'll offer them up the performance studio.
Oh, okay, we'll do that.
You have it here.
Can we do?
It's dark, and we've got blackout curtains already. You know, it's perfectly dark in there. Just have it in there. It'll be fine.
Why can't we just have the games at night? It is the Final Four. I mean, that's good prime time. Just have it at night.
I don't know
problems.
The answer to
I'm
that.
Sure there is a stupid expensive reason why. I'm sure.
No, John, we can't contractually do that. All right, the pros and cons, mostly cons, of social media and social networking with David Gartenstein Ross coming up next.
Justice.
Talk AM 1130 1035 FM 651-989-5855 is the phone number, or use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter if you want to communicate with the show. And we are very curious to get your thoughts on this conversation that we're about to have with our regular counterterrorism expert, the
one and
phenomenal
only.
One and only David Gartenstein Ross,
author of Bin Laden's Legacy, DefendDemocracy.org, and senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Good morning, sir. How are we doing?
Doing great. It's always a good morning when I get to join you.
Now, are we supposed to be fighting? Because I know you tweeted out, and we're going to be talking about this, and you're going to throw down, and I didn't know if that was... If we were supposed to be disagreeing.
Throw down could be throw down against, or just throw down and go into some detail.
Okay.
I was anticipating that we wouldn't fight, but we can fight if you want.
I was
yes,
all prepared.
I want to see you fight.
I was all prepared for a rap battle. I was going to freestyle.
He brought horns.
Over the top of my head.
I brought a saxophone, so I'm ready to go.
There you go. Thank you for putting that to a good close. David, it's interesting because we're going to have this conversation about social media, and one of the things, when we first became friends and got to know you, we all started using Twitter, I was often very interested in the fact that often we'd go to your Twitter feed to, say, perhaps get some insight into what you've been tweeting about and what you're talking about. You were always very selective in when you would tweet. But oftentimes we'd go to your Twitter feed and you would have posted, I'm off of social networking for a while. I'll be back in a week. I'll be back in whenever. And you've kind of done that for quite a long time. Have you been doing that since you started on Twitter and social networking?
No, I haven't. I think it's me getting a little bit more wise to the medium over time. I recently posted, I really have taken about what one could think of as a 2-year disengagement, essentially. Not that I've not been posting over the past 2 years, but it's been so very occasional and hasn't really been following things. I recently reengaged, and we can talk about the reasons why, but at first when I came to Twitter, it was a very different medium. You know, those who came to Twitter around the time I did, which is around 2009, can understand this. It was much smaller then. It wasn't yet infested by bots. You know, trolling wasn't as big. You know, people weren't necessarily there to fight. And in my field, which is kind of the foreign policy field, analysis of sub-state violence, terrorism, and the like, there was a common bond by the fact that I and other folks were on Twitter because not everyone was there. It wasn't thought of as the norm for people in my field. So just the fact that you were on Twitter with someone created at least the illusion of friendship, but I thought that was healthy. Over time, I found it just became more and more overwhelming, and I realized, and physiological studies bear this out, that time spent on social media, like if I'm working too hard and need a break, which happens to me occasionally, I tend not to take days off. I'm trying to change that. But like historically, I haven't taken days off even over weekends. And so if I need a period where I'm just kind of getting R&R and trying to recharge, being on social media means not really having time away. And so that's why I was particular about if I need a week to recharge, I'm not going to be on Twitter. I'm not going to be on Facebook during that time.
Now, you said that you disengaged for a while from social media of all different types. What did you find out during that time frame? And then subsequently, what ended up kind of bringing you back?
So interestingly, during that time frame, I wasn't just reflecting on social media. I was actually very actively doing work that fundamentally related to social media. This includes not just kind of extensive desk research on things like radicalization, but some of the projects I had had me going to places and working in places specifically on social media where the rise in internet penetration to levels of 50% of the population or above was a relatively recent phenomenon. So this included spending a week in Nigeria organizing a conference for civil society activists who had a social media presence and getting them to think about how militant groups like Boko Haram use social media and having them put together their own sort of strategic action plan with respect to violent extremism. Similarly, doing work on the impact of social media in Bulgaria, in Morocco, and really deeply engaging people from those countries about this phenomenon. So I was able to get a perspective that was cross-cultural and across several different countries with respect to what happens as we hit a certain level of internet penetration and as people come to get online and specifically online with social media. And so to me, the fundamental thing, there are two fundamental takeaways that I got. One of them, I think, is more personal, and one of them is more systemic. The personal one is I feel that social media, I don't feel, I know this. If you're familiar with the concept of the signal and the noise, Nate Silver wrote a famous book with that title. The signal is the information that matters, and the noise is everything else. Social media is 98% noise, right? It's a good place if if something major happens, there are some figures whose views I want to know on social media. The vast majority of tweets are not going to provide me useful information about subject matters that are important. But moreover, the vast majority of tweets are not going to be about important subject matters. And unfortunately, this actually is mirrored in the media these days. I still love CNN, but if you look at their coverage these days, it's become kind of the Donald Trump channel, in this case, the anti-Donald Trump channel, where, like, Donald Trump tweets will be driving the coverage of CNN when there are actually more important things in the world than what the president is tweeting about on any given day.
Well, I don't want to keep on your line of thinking, but just as an example, and we were talking about this yesterday, we made kind of a big deal in mocking it, but CNN had put out a tweet just a day or two ago that Emma Gonzalez, one of the survivors of Parkland, Florida, it basically was, Emma Gonzalez now has more Twitter followers than the NRA.
Yeah, it wasn't just a tweet, it was an actual story.
And it ended up being an actual story.
Right.
That's not news.
Right. And also, moreover, it comes from, you know, there obviously is a perspective that's clearly embedded within it. I've talked to lots of journalists who all have kind of similar views. And again, like, I think, you know, I have some closeness to the station, so I don't want to come down too hard on them. But if I did come down hard on them, it wouldn't necessarily be undeserved. And there are a number of really good journalists who work there. But I think that their coverage is now off kilter. But that mirrors the conversation on social media, where the noise to signal ratio is really high. But the second thing, not the personal thing, but the systemic thing, let me actually impact the personal thing for a second. To impact that, what I've found, given this noise to signal ratio, is that in all of our lives, there's a time trade-off. I think you both have kids, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, so do I, two little girls, and that puts more pressure on your time. Your time becomes more precious once you have kids because you just have far less time. And so it trades off against other things. And I found that, you know, in the time that I spend on social media, and this is the case for so many of us, like, there's a lot of things you could do, whether it's establishing, you know, a new exercise routine or learning a new language or, you know, spending more time with family. And that noise-to-signal ratio makes social media less attractive than a lot of other options. Then the second thing, though, the systemic thing, is that it provides the wrong incentives. This is something that people are now kind of realizing post-2016 election. You know, there's a good piece in BuzzFeed about the coming information apocalypse where Aviv Ovadia, it tells his story of going around and talking to social media companies and tech companies and getting kind of blank stares. But if you look at social media, it has completely gamified public discourse. You know, the success on social media, if you can define success, it's attention, it's retweets, it's favorites, it's things that drive your clout score. And what drives those metrics is conflict, polarization, a view that gets reactions. This is not how good thinkers actually work. And I find that what's popular, you know, Mark Twain said, if you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect. Meaning, you know, it's really when you find that people agree with you that you should question your views, not when you come up against great disagreement. And, you know, in my field of study, which is terrorism, substate violence, we've talked a number of times, and you've seen this unfold, about how there have been tremendous misreadings by major analysts of events, particularly the Arab Spring, which we talked about at the time when everyone in my field was saying that this was going to end jihadism. And, you know, my position all along was not so fast. We can now see very clearly, 7 years after the fact, that the majority of analysts were wrong. I was right that it was not the death knell for jihadism, and in fact, it helped these terrorist groups in multiple ways. And I think one reason that people got things wrong, I mean, there's multiple, it doesn't come down to just how we communicate, but social media can create a false consensus. Right, like you can see right away, you can take a poll as to basically based on how people react, as to how popular your ideas are, which for most people, because people tend to be wired this way, tends to incentivize playing to a chorus, and it can thus throw our ideas and our approach to the world off kilter, because rather than kind of sitting back and reflecting, we look to the crowd, many of us trust the wisdom of the crowd, and that's not always the right play.
You know, and it's interesting, too, we got into based off of some of the notes you had provided, we got into a conversation on air, and actually we did for a bit this morning, talking about how you get this inflated opinion of people. People on Twitter simply having the blue check mark by their name, suddenly there's a level of credibility there with that individual that their comments perhaps might be more important than somebody that doesn't have a blue check mark by their name. And I think you're really, really onto something when you look at social media and the people who we follow, the comments that we read, and individuals who really aren't any better than, and their opinions aren't any better than somebody else's, but simply because they're from a particular media outlet or a particular website or they have that blue check mark, their comments are taken with more weight. And I think it ends up spiraling into that sort of consensus that builds around that of people that end up agreeing with them based off of that person's more special, so I'm going to listen to them.
Right, and I think it plays out in different ways of social media. One is the blue check mark, which one can call the elitist bent of social media, although that I think actually isn't a change, right? If you go back to kind of the pre-social media days, just before social media, some people had a megaphone and some people didn't. And, you know, John, Andrew, both, you know, you were lucky. You were both people with megaphones. I was someone with a megaphone. I'd frequently be on, you know, radio and TV and the like. And so the blue check marks are essentially people who had megaphones who now have blue check marks by their name. So another kind of way in which I think this occurs is not the elitist blue check mark versus non. And I do agree with you that a blue check mark doesn't incur any kind of special knowledge of the world, except, of course, in my case. But the second thing is you also have the kind of political band. We can call it political tribal identity. Where the other flip side of that, and one can see this actually very clearly on various sides of the political fence, where people will kind of find someone to be distrusted because they disagree with their politics, which I think is one of the stupidest things in general, because, you know, generally speaking, and increasingly we have much more of a heterogeneous political environment where some movements are now far outside typical American norms. But generally speaking, if you look at kind of, if you break down Republicans and Democrats, when it comes to world politics, we tend to be actually within a fairly narrow band, and for some reason completely hate each other, even though our views aren't, you know, all that divergent. You know, political differences do matter. But one thing for me is, you know, the world is an extraordinarily confusing place. You know, the problems we face are quite complex, and I think that the right answer to a lot of the things we face is not clear. I think there are some right answers which are extraordinarily clear, but every right answer I've gotten to, which I find to be clear now, it took me a lot of work to get there. And so this is another problem with social media. Not only does it incentivize, you know, polarization, but it really incentivizes people who are so definite in their views. And let's forget the vast majority. For basically every single extraordinarily popular, you know, Twitter personality, there's no way in which, if you break them down as a public intellectual, the confidence level in their views can match the degree of confidence that someone should have in their views. Generally speaking, we specialize in a few things. There are a few things we know well. And when someone takes a wide variety of opinions based on what kind of political class they put themselves in, that's not someone I would trust to run a society. And yet, that is the kind of thing which makes someone incredibly popular on social media.
So, like, the influence that the popular people on social media, the influencers, if you will, the influence that they have is sort of far outweighs the value of their actual contributions to any sort of discourse or discussion.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So where do we go?
I think actually, I would argue that you actually have kind of an inverse curve there, where the more influence someone has, almost certainly the less valuable their contributions are. Because by the time you get more influence, you understand the crowd you're playing to. Like, people tend to be more interesting before they get popular because of the way the system is gamed, right? Success for a tweet is retweets and likes and reactions. There's extraordinarily stupid article I read a while back, which a lot of people seem to like, about how you tell that something's a bad tweet, and it's called the ratio. And basically, when the number of reactions outstrip by far the number of retweets, it's supposed to be a bad tweet, which I thought is the reason why it's a stupid argument is because it doesn't say whether it's a good tweet or a bad tweet. All it says is that people dislike it. The fact that people dislike an argument being made doesn't invalidate it. Mm-hmm. Like, if you think of, Galileo, when, when he was arguing about the shape of the universe, he might get more comments on his tweets if you had Twitter back then than he got retweets. That doesn't, invalidate the notion that we have a heliocentric universe.
But the point I'm getting at here is, my contributions to the Twitter sphere are clearly incredibly valuable because I'm not getting a lot of retweets and likes and replies. So if the inverse is true, then clearly my contributions should be much more widely respected. Thank you, David. That's the validation that I was really looking for from you.
And then I kind of get a lot of those retweeted, so I used to chalk it up to me being clever. Now I don't feel that way.
I want to shift this conversation into where we go from here. Like I think we can all agree that the mentioned earlier, the influence that a lot of people have on social media isn't really warranted, and that the value of the discourse is really dumbed down and isn't really contributing much of value to society or to politics. But I want to know where do we go from here?
Yeah, David, hang on. We're going to spend more time talking with David Garchenstein Ross, DefendDemocracy.org. We'll get into that, some specific negatives associated with social media, the hostility as well. Also dive a bit into why David ended up re-engaging. I have a question too coming up, based off of what we've talked about so far, of how much social networking has actually driven perhaps a change in the way the news is delivered, like say via CNN. We'll dive into more of this. Get to your phone call, 651-989-5855, or use that hashtag TCNT on Twitter.
Justice in